Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's show, we'll be talking with a blind woman and her unusual journey through dealing with blindness and other issues.
Anastasia Haralambakos recently published her memoir, From Darkness to Triumph, Creating Success Amidst Barriers, and we'll be speaking with her about both the content of the book and later in the show, the mechanics of creating and publishing it. But first to our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Anastasia.
In life, especially when you're blind, you are going to get told no a lot, and you have to be able to go on in spite of that no. And sometimes when people do tell us no, I mean, there really are some valid reasons, but a lot of times when they say it, it's because they are not informed, and it's also a fear. How can they do this or that? Or what happens if we let them into the program? Or can we ourselves handle, you know, a blind student or a blind worker or whatever? You know, so it's a combination of things.
Yeah, I think often others who haven't been through the experience lack the imagination, and it's very easy for them to come up with a host of reasons why something can't be done, rather than thinking creatively about maybe different approaches to how a task can be accomplished.
Exactly, and that's really one of those things, again, that I try to stress in that final part about people thinking outside the box and being creative, because I think it's very important.
But as Anastasia says, often we will hear no quite a bit, whether you're blind or not, and it's really up to your ambition and your drive to succeed and work out ways of accomplishing what you want to accomplish.
Now, we actually did an entire show on that topic in which we had a half a dozen guests talking about their experiences and their attitudes, and if you want to listen to that, that's show 1349. Let's start by meeting Anastasia and learning about what motivated her to write her memoir.
I'm Anastasia Haralambakos. I was born and raised in New York City, but my family and I reside in Sarasota, Florida, and we've been here for 25 years. I attended Sarasota Middle School, Sarasota High School, and graduated with my bachelor's degree in history from Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and then went on to earn a master's in applied linguistics from the University of South Florida. I worked in sales at Freedom Scientific, and I've also been teaching since I got my master's. I teach English to non-native speakers. I do a lot of online tutoring and editing.
Now, I know from reading your book, which we'll talk about a little later, that you are visually impaired. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of your visual impairment?
Sure. I am totally blind in both eyes. I was born prematurely. I heard from my parents, of course, they tell me that I was a pound and a few ounces, and it's what I have is called retinopathy of prematurity. I was put in an incubator and was there for at least 3 months, and it's an overdose of oxygen.
And I take it you're a JAWS user and use Braille, and do you use a dog or a cane?
I am a JAWS user. I use Braille. I've been using it since I was in first grade, and I just use a cane.
And tell our listeners what the title of your book is.
From Darkness to Triumph, Creating Success Amidst Barriers.
Is From Darkness to Triumph your first major literary work?
Actually, it is. It really, really is my first work. I wrote it actually for quite a few reasons. One, to help answer a lot of the questions that people have had for me over the years about blindness. And second, to bring to light some of these very important issues that I experienced as a child, not just with the blindness, but just the general things we talked about, the family circumstances, to bring those to the forefront, to the social work profession, and to parents, and to help people to understand, this is what we feel like as kids when you guys as adults make us, you know, change schools or argue in the middle of the night, bring us into the adult world, you know, when we're too young to actually be thrust into that world and should be actually playing outside and laughing with our friends and living that carefree life. This is what we feel like when we are deprived of that. This is what happens when we lose things that we love, like for me it was the music. This is how we feel, and these are the changes that need to be made, you know. So I wanted to bring these things to the forefront.
And I can personally recommend this book. I thought it was very interesting and tells a very compelling story of her journeys through a difficult home environment, moving a lot, people saying no, and then also dealing with her blindness.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is a discussion of some of the contents of Anastasia's recently published memoir. Now, her life's been somewhat unusual, but she's raised many issues, which I'm sure many of our listeners will be able to resonate with, whether or not the details of her life story are the same as yours. And we think you'll enjoy hearing her discussion of this.
So I just finished reading your book, From Darkness to Triumph, and it was a very engaging book and told a very interesting story of your life, and I thought maybe we could go through a little bit of that.
Of course.
One thing I thought was interesting growing up blind was adjusting to and learning about the visual world around you, and I was very taken with your experiences at the Lighthouse in terms of how they taught a blind child to learn about the world. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. The Lighthouse, they have a child development center. They had and still do. And, you know, for the blind children, it's designed to give them concrete hands-on experiences. And that's very important to a totally blind child because a sighted child can absorb his or her environment visually. I mean, a sighted child can see, well, how someone holds a phone, you know, when his mother or father is talking on it. They can see how a fork is held or anything like that, how people move about. But for those of us who are blind, there's a lack of that visual sensory stimulation coming in. So what they do is they have a lot of activities, bowling, swimming, swinging, whatever. They had a playground. So our day was full of a lot of concrete things. We went on a lot of trips, again, where we could touch things. We read stories. We played with different toys, different puzzles. We were given a lot of things to do, like to develop our daily living skills, like pass out cups and crackers, and literally taught, again, hand over hand, how to open these crackers and how to sweep the crumbs off the table. And I think it's very, very important that as blind children, we're taught these skills at a very young age. And again, it's also good for not just for us, but for socialization, to have these social skills.
But it's very interesting. You describe those, what most people would think of very simple tasks, that if you're seeing the world, you absorb it, but you just don't know those things are happening when you're blind. One of your other descriptions was about knowing when your clothes were inside out or not. And, you know, if the tag is here, it should be there. And here are the buttons. And just feeling that, you know, most sighted kids would just see that and it would come naturally.
Exactly.
Adults take a lot of that for granted.
They don't think about it because I guess when you can see or hear or whatever, when you have all your senses, there's no need for them to think about just how they go about their daily lives. I mean, it's actually in some ways just like me. I mean, I don't really think about, well, I'm blind today, you know, how am I going to make that bed? How am I going to go grocery shopping? How am I going to, I just go out, I do what I need to do. I know that I need to ask for help in advance, and I accomplish the tasks that need to be achieved that way.
So were your parents that way at home also, trying to teach you the visual world and teach you to be independent?
Not 100%, but my mom was very overprotective, and she wanted to do everything for me. And I think this is normal. My premature birth had really scared her. It had frightened her immensely, and she thought that by overprotecting me, she was actually doing me a favor. But doing that to a child is not doing a blind child a favor. I think you want to have a logical standard, just like you would, you know, for a sighted child. You would expect that blind child to know how to wash the dishes, you know, how to clean, how to do whatever, you know, age-appropriate tasks. have that child do things from a young age. Again, because why? Because it's important for daily living skills, socialization skills. And plus, you know, this is a tricky, you know, and difficult world that we live in. It's challenging. So the more strength and confidence that a blind child builds from a young age, the more equipped I think that child is going to be later on to fight for him or herself when someone sighted is saying, well, you can't do this or you can't do that. Then you're going to be able to stand up for yourself and say, I can't. I've done this. I've done that.
Well, and Pete's parents were really, really good about that. And as a result, he's very self-sufficient, but he was born with congenital glaucoma and had basically very low vision as a child, sufficiently low to go to a school for the blind, but he had some vision so he could navigate. But it was a challenge. I mean, his mom wanted to baby him so bad and had to force herself not to at every step of the way.
It's very common. And this is, you know, and I hope that parents will listen, you know, hopefully to this, because it's very important. I mean, I would say don't do it as much as you can. It's a natural parental instinct, but please don't do it. This is another thing that I do talk about in my book, in the final section, especially a lot, where I really try to bring that up so we can hopefully eliminate some of these issues that I think a lot of the blind population is still facing. And I see a lot of these things, and it does hinder daily living. It hinders the possibility of getting a job. So this is why I really, really stress to parents, teachers, and other professionals, please don't baby, you know, blind children and blind teens. Let them experience the world. Let them take elective classes in high school. Let them succeed and fail too, because you have to learn from both things.
In the book, you talk about moving around a lot as a child and attending lots of different schools. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Moving actually has consequences, you know, socially. You have to adjust culturally to a new neighborhood. You have to adjust to your new school. And I experienced all of these things, especially not knowing English very well. It created a lot of instability. And everywhere I went, I had to relearn my environment, to reorient to it. The curriculums, you know, were a little bit different from one town to another, actually. I had to adjust that way, and I had to have tutors sometimes to help me out. And it really was very difficult. And I think what would have helped a lot was to have that stability, to stay in one school, to establish roots there. On the other hand, I think when you do move, you can become resilient. You can learn to adapt. So those are a couple of the positive things that I think people can, you know, can gain out of moving, but not to the point where you move so much that it just kind of outweighs those positive benefits.
I'm curious about the social aspect. Kids, especially in the lower grades, they really don't like to stick out. And as the only blind kid in the class, you would stick out. And as the new kid in the class, you would stick out.
Definitely.
Did you find that being both at the same time, every time you switched schools, kind of mitigated how different you felt as being blind because you were new or vice versa? Or did you just feel so different and sticking out so much?
It's interesting. Okay. In first and second grade, I was in what they called the self-contained classroom, which meant that I was with other blind and partially sighted children. So in that regard, we were common. However, you know, where we were alike, as if what would happen in a, quote, let's say, fully sighted classroom, even these kids, you know, whether they're blind or partially sighted, they had their own cliques. And I just didn't fit in somehow. Oh, well, actually, we moved in the middle of the year a lot. And I think when you move like that, then all the groups have been kind of, you know, established or pre-established at the beginning of the year. So, and I was sort of new in that way, because here I was right in the middle of the school year and these groups had been formed. And yes, I felt alone sometimes. I felt like I didn't want to go to school and I cried a lot.
So we talked about some of your early schooling, and I know you from your book that you went to college in the 90s. And it sounds like in addition to these numerous other barriers, moving, being blind, etc., your teachers were not particularly encouraging of the field you wanted to pursue. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. I really wanted to do music, and I was very involved, you know, with music from a very young age, particularly voice and piano. I wanted to be a classical opera singer. I really did encounter a lot of negativity. Well, I think the blindness was one aspect. They kept telling me, well, you can't really perform on stage because of your blindness, you have to be able to see certain things. And in some respects, I think to do opera would be tricky in that regard. I mean, I'd have to, you know, work with director and the staff, you know, the crew one-on-one on certain things. And I have done a lot of theater, and I was able to achieve a lot, even though I was told no. The other reason I think that they were saying that was from a more, I think, quote, realistic, unquote, standpoint, career-wise and financially. I think, you know, voice performance, the competition is very, very steep out there, and there's a lot of talent. And they felt that I would do better if I had a, quote, you know, more practical, you know, quote, academic endeavor to pursue. I think that's really the other reason why they were saying that. I was still persistent, and I got into the performing arts program in high school, and, you know, I really wanted to stay with it. But again, some of the things that I was discouraged about, I think, were really frivolous. And I think had the teachers been a little bit more open-minded, my parents more supportive, I would have been okay and been able to stay in the program for all 4 years. So I decided that, although it was a very, very painful and a very difficult decision, I had to let go of that program and try to find other ways to compensate for that. And what I did was I sang in Sarasota High's mixed chorus. I was in the soprano section. And then I became involved in the Sarasota Youth Opera, and I took voice lessons as much as I could. So again, it's that resilience and that adapting, trying to find another way to accommodate to that. Now they have, of course, even more programs than what they had when I was in school, which was dual enrollment, doing stuff, you know, the virtual school. So even here you go, even more opportunities to do stuff that didn't exist when I was in Sarasota High.
So what impresses me after reading your book is that you came through many of these hurdles and lack of support, and I know you came from a very difficult family environment, which is pretty evident in the book also, and all these barriers, somehow you came through it and being very upbeat, very positive. And how did that all work out? I mean, you know, I don't see any bitterness in your book or negativity.
Well, okay, first of all, I have a lot of faith in God. And second, I think bitterness destroys a person's soul. Did I lose a lot of my childhood to these very difficult family circumstances and my parents separating and coming back many times, you know, having to go to the women's shelter with my mom? I'd say yes, I lost a lot of my childhood to these things. Is it necessary for us to suffer like that? No. But for me, it made me a better person, a more understanding person, and a more compassionate person. So I chose understanding and compassion over bitterness and being negative. I have a lot of love for life, and I'm very, very grateful and thankful to be here and to impact the lives of others as much as I can. And I think those are the things that really make me excited and really happy to live each day.
You know, I think in so many ways that a bit of adversity can really instill a lot of gratitude that things aren't any worse. You know, you have a near-death experience and all of a sudden you're grateful to be alive. And whereas the previous week, you're just like, well, yeah, I'm alive. Of course I'm alive. I was alive yesterday. I'm still alive.
Really, really, exactly. I mean, so I hope that people would come out of adversity okay, and that they would change, that they will see, you know, how that can make them stronger instead of negative. And I think people do in general, I think, tend to change after something adverse.
Well, I think what's really interesting about your book is not only is it a very engaging story of your life, particularly growing up blind and how different that is, but that you did go through all this adversity and came out really very positive and great on the other end. You know, I'd like to see other people do that more often in their lives around the world, and it isn't necessarily blindness that causes adversity for people.
Exactly. And you have a very valid point, because in this case, it really was not blindness, because my, you know, divorcing, separating, whatever, arguing, shelters, those things have nothing to do with blindness. Any sort of child can be in that kind of predicament. And again, I think it goes back to one's own resilience and strength and being able to say, I want to become a better person than this.
Another interesting observation that I came away with from the book was So you've overcome all these barriers and hurdles very successfully, and you have that inner drive. And, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to think, well, that's behind me. I overcame that problem. Now life is going to be wonderful. But even as you got older, there are still issues with trying to find employment, even though you have the background and the skills, and people not being very receptive to hiring a blind person. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. Well, my bachelor's degree in history, that's a very broad thing, and it's not easily applicable, but I think, you know, what I did, so I went back to grad school and I worked very, very hard. And when I got out, I mean, I thought, well, I'm going to find a job in teaching, but it actually became very difficult in my area because, again, employers felt, well, what can she really do the job? How can we adapt? Is she going to need an assistant? And it became difficult to kind of dispel those myths in some of these employers. I prefer to teach at English language institutes, you know, for older adults. I just like that environment very much. In my circumstance, a lot of the work in that kind of setting is adjunct. So to move to a different state, adjunct pay without anyone behind me would have been a little bit difficult because you really have to make enough to be able to support yourself financially. You know, it's very expensive out there. So what I've decided to do, although my hope has been, you know, was to teach in an actual classroom setting because I really enjoy it. So unfortunately, what I had to do is adapt in that regard again and do my own tutoring online and create my own work as much as possible. That's what I do now. And I decided I wanted to be an author. I wanted to be one of those things that I wanted to do for a living is to write. So again, I've had to adapt in that regard. And when you can't find work, I think if you have a skill that you could take and transfer it to a different branch like I've done, which is, okay, well, how can I use my skills? I'm not in the classroom where I really want to be. So what else can I do? How can I use these skills that I get in grad school? I had to talk to myself and say, okay, well, I can write, I can edit, I can tutor non-native English speakers and help them with their grammar. I've done it. In fact, I worked with a student, you know, from Morocco on the TOEFL, which is the Test of English as a Foreign Language. We went through all the different sections of the exam, and we worked submitting stuff back and forth by email, working on Skype, using JAWS. So that's what I've had to do. So I don't want people out there to give up. I'd like for them to do, you know, a couple of things if they can't find work. Again, one, use whatever skills they have to see if it's transferable to something else. And second, see if they have a professional network or someone that can be an advocate and help them to open a door. I really think building networks, professional networks, is very, very important. And what I would tell, you know, young college kids now that are going through school is, if you're in the dormitory, if you live on campus or wherever you are, don't hibernate in the dorm. Get involved in extracurricular activities, student government, whatever you want to get involved in, other clubs. Find those internship programs, those co-op programs, and build a professional network. And don't lose touch with your professional network when you leave school. And don't burn bridges.
That's great advice for anybody, sighted or not.
Exactly.
Now for this week's final item, how Anastasia published the book, how you can get a hold of it on paper or in digital format, how to contact her, and then some final thoughts. I was thinking about the mechanics of writing and publishing a book. I assume I understand the writing part. You sit down in front of a keyboard and you type, and then you edit, and then you type some more. What about the mechanics of getting a book published?
It can be a little tricky, especially if you want to find an agent. I, for right now, chose to go the self-publishing route, and still it was a process. I had to find a qualified graphic designer who would do the cover and the actual layout, the formatting of the book and the chapters and the headings. And then once everything was finished and past approval, you know, for my mom and my friends that I valued their feedback, we went to CreateSpace, which is a company that works with Amazon, and we uploaded the files. And there's like tons of paperwork to fill out, like forms that say, you know, who is your editor? Who is your graphic designer? Your author's name? Where do you want the book to appear? Do you want it to be on just Kindle? Do you want it in ebook? Do you want, you know, things like that? So once all of that was submitted to CreateSpace, you had to wait a little bit, like 24 hours, for them to look at the files. They make sure you haven't plagiarized anywhere, make sure that it meets their printing specifications. And then if it passes, they post it. It goes to Amazon. That's pretty much the process, aside from the tremendous amount of editing and revising and the hours that go into this, you know, before publication.
So now it's one thing getting it up on Amazon, but then how do people know it's there? What do you do about publicizing?
A lot of marketing. You have to going through interviews, and they can be hard to get. What else? You have to also find organizations and places that are relevant to your book. So for example, like my book has a lot of different aspects, which is traveling, social work, blindness. From these aspects, I can go to different agencies or different organizations, like for example, ACB, NFE, you guys, different schools for the blind, for example, Division of Blind Services, and talk about the book, lighthouses, social work aspect, different universities, organizations such as Spark in Sarasota, which is Safe Place, Safe Crisis Center. So again, it's finding where the niche that your book falls under and marketing to those agencies, you know, and the people that would be interested in this kind of a book.
That sounds like a lot of work if you want to do it right.
Trust me, you have to be very, very patient, because if you're starting out as an author that's not known, kind of like I am, then you have to start working really hard, and it takes a lot of time to build. But it's worth it in the end.
So I enjoyed this book a whole lot, and I'd like to encourage others, cited or not, to read this book. Where can people get a hold of it?
Amazon.com in paperback. It's also available, you know, on Kindle there. And smashwords.com if they want just like PDF format or other EPUB or whatever, or other formats, that's where they can go. And I also, you know, wanted to mention too, that when they read the book, that I am also a speaker. So I do travel, and I do go to schools and organizations, and I speak about this whole book.
And so how can people contact you?
Right now, if people want to contact me, my email address is achara22427@hotmail.com.
And here are some final thoughts from Anastasia that we'd like to leave you with.
Don't give up. Be strong. And blind or sighted, and I will just say, everyone to the world, please be open-minded, be creative, and be progressive thinkers. And pass on kindness whenever you can. That's the best thing I can say.
Wow. And that's just such a great summary of how you've lived your life and how you wrote about it in your book.
Well, thank you.
And as usual, you can go to www.eyesonsuccess.net to look at the show notes, where we'll have links to places where you can find the book and contact Anastasia, etc. I should also point out that we got Anastasia's name from a listener of ours, and you can join our listener forum by sending an email note to eyesonsuccess, followed by the plus sign, followed by subscribe, @googlegroups.com, and then you can connect with our listeners and get weekly announcements of upcoming shows.
Or you can send us email at hosts@eyesonsuccess.net. And if you'd prefer, you can also contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or Audioboo.
We enjoy hearing from all our listeners and get many good ideas from them. Thanks to everyone.
That's it for show number 1421. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the intersection of usability and accessibility. We'll speak with Whitney Quesenberry, who, with co-author Sarah Horton, recently published a comprehensive book on the subject entitled A Web for Everyone, Designing Accessible User Experiences. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and Audioboo at Eyes on Success, and on Twitter @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.